Welcome to our program on KGVM, Gallatin Valley Rodeo, 95.9 FM, KGVM.org. I'm Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. This is Health and Happiness program, originally begun by the Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association, which we have continued for almost 8 years. We speak of issues of mental health, but basically anything to enhance our health and happiness. Dr. Suzanne now introduces today's program.
We have a special interest in today's topic since we have personal experience with having a disabled child growing up and growing old in our family. In fact, according to the World Health Organization, this happens with every 20 births. 1 in 20 children may be different and may give us unexpected birth events. And we're so fortunate today that we have Kim Griffin to share with us her perceptions and recommendations as she cares for 2 children with disabilities. Kim is a vibrant professional in the media world, and you can find her at thekimgriffin.com. We need to schedule an entire show about Kim's acting, writing, and broadcast career. But today, she's gracing us with perspectives and advice about complicated motherhood. Thank you so much, Kim. And welcome.
Thank you, Suzanne and Arliss. It's so nice to be here. I really appreciate being granted the opportunity to share my perspectives and some of our experience as a family, especially in light of some of the national conversations that are happening. I really appreciate it, and it's so good to share with your audience. Thank you.
And particularly in light of the changes occurring that maybe people need to be made aware of. And so we appreciate your joining us with that information, Kim.
Absolutely. Where shall we begin? What would you like to hear about first?
Well, we've known Kim since she was born just a few days apart from our little girl across the street years ago in Oklahoma City. So we know you've had a long and illustrious career, and what we'd like to hear about on this topic would be your expectations when you were pregnant and how maybe you weathered the new information that came about, Kim.
You know, my experience is not unique in the sense that I did not know I was going to have kids with differences or disabilities or genetic anomalies. Not until with our second child. She was born early, and she was born on the small side, and I had experienced high-risk pregnancy with my daughter, and they were on the lookout for a lot of things because of what had happened when I gave birth to my son. But we didn't know, you know, with my daughter, she was born, and she was, I want to say, 4 pounds, 15 ounces at 37.5. So not quite preemie, but there were concerns because of her size about her lungs. And within 48 hours, she had a lot of trouble maintaining her body temperature. And they had concerns about her glycemic numbers and all sorts of things, and recommended a move to the PEDS unit, which was their NICU. And she went in, and 2 days later they came to us and they said, you know, we're seeing some, you know, what they call floppiness, which is a really horrific term, but it is about muscular weakness. Most babies will kind of tense up and come into themselves, and babies are usually actually very strong. And our daughter was not responding strength-wise in the way the doctors were accustomed to. And so they broached the topic of genetic syndromes. And they said to us, we think she might have one of three things: Angelman syndrome, Prader-Willi syndrome, or Williams-Elvin syndrome. And we were fortunate in some ways to be in Pittsburgh, which at the time was home to the Children's Institute. The Children's Institute is still there, but has since broadened their programming. Initially, they were a standalone treatment center for individuals with Prader-Willi syndrome, which we did eventually get a diagnosis. It was about 5 weeks in the hospital, in the NICU. We left the hospital at one point, and she had a hypoxic episode where she stopped breathing. And we went back to the hospital and were immediately moved into the NICU, where she experienced a spinal tap. And because she experiences venous issues, you know, we had a lot of really scary things happen that are very common for parents of NICU graduates. And I probably should have given a trigger warning before talking or something, but we experienced, you know, a lot of very intense medical interventions. And it was my second time in the NICU, but it was a much, it was a really interesting perspective into the limitations of what doctors can do when they don't have answers. And if you're really fortunate, as we often, most for the most part, where we had really spectacular doctors at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, but there are doctors who are very, you know, the research angle can be so beneficial, and there's a point at which, as a parent, you just need to wait for the information. And we kind of hit a point between weeks 3 and 5 where we were waiting for the difference between the fish and the full genetic spectrum. So if you have a child that's suspected of having a genetic anomaly, they'll do kind of an initial genetic test that's not quite as broad, that's called the microfish, and they look at that and they rule things out. And so our initial experience was the fish came back and they were like, oh, it's not genetic, she's okay. So then the doctors really wanted to do all kinds of tests. We had doctors that wanted to cut a piece of her muscle out to test it. We had one doctor, I stood next to her, and she put a needle through each of Nev's muscles to test whether or not they were functional, responsive. She eventually was given a G-tube because she was having swallowing issues, and that was, I think, around the time that we got to the full spectrum genetic testing, the microarray back, and were told that it was in fact Prader-Willi. Prader-Willi is a genetic syndrome that impacts the 15th chromosome. And the way that I like to explain it, as not a scientist, who, as you said, I'm an actor. I don't know from science, but I've had some crash tests at this point. And what I like to say is, if you picture kind of, you know, if you just draw a tree with a trunk and some limbs on either side, that's kind of what your genome looks like. And so with Prader-Willi, what we like consider a normal genetic sequence is to have mom, dad on one side and then the other of the trunk as you go up. And what happens with Prader-Willi is that most typically you get a paternal deletion, which means it goes mom, dad, mom, nothing, mom. Or you get a maternal redundancy. Mom, dad, mom on the wrong side, more mom. That's what's called a uniparental disomy, or UPD. And that is what accounts for roughly 30% of cases of Prader-Willi, which impacts 1 in 15 to 20,000 live births. Prader-Willi impacts people across race and sexuality or gender equally, which is kind of unique. There are some genetic syndromes that are more specific, and we've been really beneficial that because of Prader-Willi's kind of ubiquity, when Nev was born, there were a lot of people in Pittsburgh who knew about Prader-Willi. The manager of the Pittsburgh Pirates, Clint Hurdle, at the time, had a daughter who had Prader-Willi syndrome and was very, very active in galvanizing the community and kind of creating events. So on that end, we were really, really fortunate because Nev was born with kind of a one in a million genetic syndrome, and we were in a place where doctors knew what it was, and we were immediately put in touch with community. And at this point in my life, 11 years into my journey as a genetic, kind of a mom working with genetic syndromes, I have many friends whose children are impacted by a vast array of syndromes or birth anomalies that impact their neurological capacity, etc. And it's so hard if you have a child with no community around you. And that's an alienating thing, even if you have a great family, even if you have a job with peers that are excited for you. Nothing can touch the sense of isolation that comes from nobody understands this path that I'm being asked to walk and the needs of this person that I'm responsible for.
Well said, Kim.
Thanks.
So
that was more of an answer probably than you bargained for with pregnancy, but
it was just perfect. It was just what we don't know and what we need to know. And so isn't it just golden that you were in a place where they knew about this and they were able to advise you and support you?
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the enormous stresses it places on the family?
Absolutely. I think for us, this has been the hardest year between the two kids. My older child is living with a mood disorder and is very, very high functioning, high masking, autistic, and ADHD. And with that, it's really difficult because nobody can see it. Uh-huh. And people don't believe that there are the challenges that we face. I've been gaslit by doctors. I've been really minimized by family members who meant the best in the world and want to see things positively, but who are unable to live in the discomfort of, oh, someone I love and care about needs something else or is having a really hard time. We as a family, you know, I'm a privileged white person with, you know, proximity to generational wealth. So I never feel like I want to complain about anything. But I can tell you that I haven't been invited to a Christmas party at a friend's house with my kids. In the 8 years that I've lived in LA, I've been invited to two or three. Because accommodations are scary to people because no one wants to get it wrong. Because, which again, I don't want to get it wrong. I have to live in a house where, I guess I kind of buried the lead, you know, with Prader-Willi syndrome. What does that mean? It's a genetic syndrome impacting the 15th chromosome. It has a broad spectrum of behaviors and implications ranging from the, quote, floppiness or low muscle tone, globalized hypotonia, right?
Yes.
Which essentially means that she can fall much easier than other people. She might not catch herself. She doesn't have the stamina of other people. Persons with Prader-Willi most commonly have a real inability to assess their body temperature. So she lacks the ability to know if she should take off a sweater as the day gets warmer, which can impact lethargy, her ability to focus, her overall mood. But the hallmark of the syndrome is that those with it between the ages of 3 and 8 develop what is called hyperphagia. Hyperphagia means an inability to feel sated or full. So what that means is that no matter how much my daughter or somebody with Prader-Willi eats, they still feel hungry. And what's confusing and dangerous about that is depending on the ability of that person to seem high functioning, they may not talk to you implicitly and say, I want food. For example, Suzanne, if my daughter met you, oh my gosh, Miss Suzanne, it's so nice to meet you. You would have the loveliest conversation. She'd probably compliment you on something you have. She might say, oh my gosh, what a nice purse. And you, maybe not knowing anything about Prader-Willi, being comfortable with my daughter because you know me, might say, yes, you can look in my purse. And any little girl's going to be curious to go through an older person's purse, probably, because there's things in there and they're maybe play acting at being grown up, whatever story we can easily see. My daughter wants to know, oh, does she have a granola bar? Is there gum? Are there mints in this purse? Right? Mm. As she gets older, it will be, is there money in this? Because money is access to food. Money is the key to getting away from the people who know about what Nev has to have, which is a food-restrictive environment. People with Prader-Willi generally are advised by their doctors to eat every 2.5 to 3 hours. They cannot, after a certain point, depending on the severity of their hyperphagia, be trusted around unsecured food. What that looks like in my home and in a great many homes, this was recommended to me by doctors, I didn't make it up, is we lock our cabinets with gun locks or whatever we can get around, you know, the handles. We lock our refrigerator. We actually, this spring, because of some heightened challenges that we experienced, put a door on the kitchen that locks. And so that means that travel for my family is really, really complicated. I would say virtually impossible, but I know a lot of Pollyanna type people that would push back on that. But the reality is trying to make sure that you can keep your kid on a calorie restricted, high protein food, you know, healthy, you know, nutrition dense diet every 2.5 to 3 hours while you drag your kids through America's airports full of Auntie Anne's pretzels and strangers that want to give them M&Ms and well-meaning people who sit right next to you and eat chicken teriyaki on the airplane is very complicated, especially with a child who, you know, in our case, we have also intellectual disability and autism mixed in with the Prader-Willi. So there's also a lot of rigid thought, black and white thinking. We have a lot of OCD scripting that Nev will drive you through. When are we going to do this? Remember, you said we were going to do this. She'll start talking you through the day's events, and she'll kind of try to sneak something in. And then we could go by the park, and we could go by that boba place. Right, she's always looking for a way to destabilize the plan because any surprise or irregularity is an opportunity for food.
You must have to be so watchful, Kim.
It's uncomfortable how watchful we have to be, yes. It's been, you know, for a woman who was raised in the thin at all costs 90s and who went through acting school and dealt with various challenges with diet and eating and self-image. I had worked really, really hard to heal and kind of be a lot more carefree with my attitudes towards food. And that pivot has been hard to navigate. It's taken me several years to learn how to confidently, strictly manage her intake and know that, you know, it's also hard if you go out and people hear me say, no, you can't have ice cream, right? The implications for a little girl, I've gotten some dirty looks, and I can't say I don't understand it, you know? But the reality is Nev's body is not as capable of processing calories in a metabolically accurate way like mine is. And every pound that she puts on would be exponentially harder to lose because of the bottom out of the metabolic threshold. So it's been, you know, as you can hear, I've learned a lot about science and medicine, a lot about psychology. We can talk about a lot of the interventions that we've utilized, and there are many, and a lot of them are really, really beneficial. You know, my family, both of my children, my husband and I, as mentioned, are performers, and I have My other career is when I'm lucky enough, I get to work at the kind of university or collegiate level, and that's great, but it's also not necessarily financially stable at all times. And so our children were both, we were really fortunate to have Medicaid. Liam was born on Medicaid in New York, and he was kept alive in large part by WIC and food stamps. And as problematic and oftentimes humiliating as it can be to participate in those services and be the recipient of them, I don't know how we would have done any of this without those services. I don't know how we would never have been able to pay for either child's stay in the NICU without Medicaid, because even seeing the explanation of benefits is enough to send me to this day into a panic attack. It's so much money. Yeah. I mean, I think Liam, you know, Liam was probably close to probably $1 million by the time he came out, because he had to do a cool capping program. He had to do 5 days of EEG monitoring with surveillance by camera to make sure that the seizure activity was matching up with what they were seeing in the feed. Nev was 57 days in the NICU and the extended care unit. And we have enough. It is still so impossible. There's no way we could pay for all of the recommended therapies, the social skills groups, the transportation to and from everything, even the gas for our own cars. I mean, you have to be in a position of obscene wealth, or you have to know how to utilize the services that are there. And so a large part of our family's life is, our whole life really is built around our children's needs. And when we had Nev, it was also the end of my appointment at the University of Pittsburgh, and they were, you know, going to keep me on adjunct, which was really not enough money to stay there. And we realized a lot of the really wonderful, the research and kind of the foundation for, or the California Prader-Willi Foundation was really, like, I think, an invaluable resource. I can't think of anything else that had the depth of, you know, recommended physicians, articles about what to tell the doctor when you go to the hospital, a little medical alert book that I printed out 10 copies of and had bound up at Staples that I keep in each car and give to every babysitter and drop off at school with her, because if there's a medical emergency, her body's needs are different than mine, and the medications that her body will respond to are maybe not what an EMT would think. And so we were looking at sort of just the services that Nev was going to continue to need, and the fact that people with Prader-Willi need to exercise all year. We were living in Pittsburgh. It was very cold. Neither of our kids really loved the freezing cold. and it's really hard to get outside for 6 or 7 months of the year. And so we looked at the kind of options, and we looked at kind of the states that had the most specialists. And between CHLA and CHOC and some specialized endocrinology groups out here, research that was being done at Stanford, research that was being done at USC, it, you know, there's also a lot of research in New York, but that was not something that we could financially facilitate with our kids. It didn't feel like the safest option. And similarly, Massachusetts. But we bet on LA, and we were, you know, able to immediately integrate into some means of community, and had access to things that, like I said, the list of doctors, which, you know, even in Pittsburgh, we kind of hit the end of, okay, we know what this is, and the, you know, doctors in the NICU know how to treat it. And we lived in a place where they love to put French fries on everything. And where people, you know, like, the reality is people in America love to show their love through food. And I'm no different. I'm not going to tell you that I didn't send my best friend huge thing of spoonful of comfort soup and rolls when she was sick last week for her family. But it is a lot easier to tell people out here in what my dad calls the land of fruits and nuts that your kids have dietary restrictions. People don't give me pushback about that out here. They are used to seeing kids that have celiac or food allergies or neurotic rich parents, and it doesn't really matter why, but they respect that boundary. And so that is something on the whole that has felt much easier to navigate than many places we go in the country. That can just be telling, especially, you know, as a new mom of a baby, all people want to do is feed a baby or give a toddler a cookie. And it frankly pisses people off when you tell them that you can't.
And that should be a lesson for each of us listening here.
Yeah. And you know, there's one study, Kim, that says when you do have a disabled child born into the family, that it increases your expenses by 35%. And then
I would think that that's a low ball number.
For you, it sounds very low. And they said it also, this was a study across all kinds of differences, but 37% decrease in income among those families. And I think yours with two children and with a Prader Willie, I think would be, you know, far above that. But just everybody should be aware that this is a real restrictive situation financially as well as otherwise.
Absolutely. When you consider the limitations of most employers, and by that I mean even if you're lucky enough to have a child with medium needs, right? Which means they maybe can't be picked up by a stranger or go to aftercare. I mean, you have to understand, things like public school aftercare are not an option for any child that needs a one-to-one aid or additional support or anything like that. So all of those parents have to have alternative means. You, even if you're lucky enough to get an aid, which I had to sue a school district to get, you still don't get them after school. The district's not going to pay for that. That's your time. So I think something that a lot of people also don't understand is that once your child turns 3 in the United States of America, everything goes over to the schools. All the therapies are administered through school, and they find a loophole to get out of providing your children services in some instances by saying, well, they don't need that to navigate the campus, or well, they're successfully navigating the campus, so we're going to, in our case, we lost physical therapy once Nev hadn't fallen for a year, you know, and could safely climb up the play structure. But that means my child, who has globalized hypotonia, needs to wear orthopedic inserts, is now considered by the U.S. government to be no longer needing additional services. Even if a doctor recommends it, that doesn't mean that insurance will cover it, because we have insurance through the ACA in addition to Medicaid. But if nobody's going to cover it, you can't pay out of pocket for pediatric physical therapy for 10 years, 15 years.
No, it's not a possibility.
Yeah, Nev is recommended for PT, OT, speech, social skills. She's followed at the hospital by neurology, genetics, endocrinology, and orthopedics at, like, all times, forever.
And that means that you are involved in this rotating cycle of one appointment after another, one treatment after another.
Mm-hmm. And then being penalized by the school for not scheduling doctor's appointments outside of school hours, which everyone on the planet knows isn't a thing.
No.
Doctors aren't seeing children at night. Doctors aren't seeing adults at night. So I don't know why teachers and administrators don't understand that. Like, they have to go see specialists if they have a disability. You know, and we have a state, I think it's Florida, that just passed a law that you can no longer have excused absences.
You're kidding.
Who's that going to penalize? Disabled kids. Kids with mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
Families who are already struggling just to have a job. And I have to say, for the record, I love working. I love what I do. I love getting to work. And it breaks my heart that we have created a society that prohibits anyone with anything remotely close to my living situation from participating in society, because that's all we want to do. And I don't care if you're serving kids or you're a janitor or you're a Subway sandwich artist. You should be able to have a job, and your job should be able to say, oh, we do, yes, we understand your child has a disability, there could be an emergency. Or we understand that you can work these hours and not those hours, and just because we're corporate, we understand that time is made up, so we're going to accommodate your need, so we have a skilled and passionate worker. But people don't do that.
Some people do, but very small percentage, and when they do, the results have been so profound that they have the most loyal workers who will go the extra mile every single time because these people understand and care and try to help.
You're very right, and thank you for saying so. It is, it's rare, but it is, you know, it's like any other area, you know. What we learn is when we are generous with other people, we receive more in return. And that's always heartening information. It's always true, and I hope we can see more of it rather than less.
So many people don't understand the stresses on caretakers. Can you talk about that and any help that you might have and suggestions to others?
Yeah, I absolutely will. I think, you know, it's a tricky situation because women, you know, no one wants to complain, and we also live in a society, and I'm sure Arliss, you could probably speak much more eloquently to this point than I can, where we are not equipped to allow people to have open-ended problems, and we don't like to sit in discomfort with each other. I've gotten very accustomed to it. I have done a lot of work. I've read a lot of self-help books. I have gone to therapy. I've quit everything so that I can afford therapy. I don't know how I would be moving around without therapy. But I know that a lot of the time people are so uncomfortable with just the struggles, and hearing about them can be really intense, you know, when you have a friend whose child is experiencing elopement from the home or running away or even just really poor behavior in public because they don't know how to manage their sensory overwhelm. We tend to pile up on the mom, and we tend to say, I have experienced so many people who are very well-meaning that want to brush things under the rug. And what I would say is, it will mean so much more to the person you're talking to if you can just listen and say, that sounds really hard, or I don't know what I would do in that situation. It sounds like you're doing the best you can. But there's a real tendency to say someone's child will grow out of it, or that God only gives you what you can handle, or that God only gives special babies to special people. And I know how strong I am. I have fought battles that no one knows about. I don't need someone to tell me that my children deserve and my family deserve to suffer and fight constantly because I'm strong. That's a very weird message that doesn't feel good to people. Caregivers are, what were you going to say?
Thank you for clarifying for our listeners out there, and I hope everyone's attending to this good, solid information, Kim. Keep going.
I think it's, you know, we think about things like a TV show, and I'm no different. We see things episodically because we experience people for the most part episodically, except for your partner, your family members, maybe if you're a student living in a dormitory or a more communal living situation, it's a little broader. Maybe it includes your work family, but we don't really, no matter how much we sit and listen to somebody in the moment, we kind of wipe their experience when we walk away. And what I would urge listeners who are invested and committed to enriching and supporting the lives of caregivers, people with disabilities, is that it doesn't stop just because we're not telling you about it. And if anything, so much more has happened than we have shared with you. There are things that have happened to me, to my children in our home that are so painful and embarrassing to talk about. And for the most part, I just don't. Like I said, I'm lucky enough to have a therapist and I take it there. There are so many more people that don't have a proper outlet or, God forbid, a supportive partner. I mean, the statistics on what having a child with differences or disability does to a marriage are heartbreaking.
They are true.
And it's unbelievable. And we've really been through the ringer. I mean, this put us to the test. We had very different responses. And my husband was raised in a very different environment. He didn't have exposure to anyone who was differently abled or had a different kind of neurotype, really. He went to private schools and he went to a small private college, and he has shared with me that he felt, you know, that there was like, he was, his first feeling was like just deep sadness that Nev wouldn't have this neurotypical experience, you know? And it really took some time for him to see, like, I mean, maybe she's going to have her own beautiful experience that we could never imagine for ourselves. You know, maybe maybe she will go to some sort of college if that's what she wants. We'll make it happen. I don't know what she'll do, but I think there's a default setting of pity or like we shouldn't talk about it. And the reality is, when you live with it every day, even if it does inspire grief, you know, to live with a child that isn't going to do things the way that you imagined or that other children get to, you know, like that's really the thing, is just watching them not have those opportunities, is that becomes its own beautiful life. That becomes its testament to the fact that we're not here to produce anything or, you know, like, and I think that's also really hard for people to confront or even consider, that like, we're not our jobs. We're not our bank balance. We're not how much we tithe at church. We're not the car we drive. We're who and how we show up to be for one another. And, you know, like the mark of kindness that we leave. I don't know if that was a complete thought.
It was very complete, Kim. And one thing that is concerning when you look at the research is that one study talked about chronic sorrow, which you were just expressing, mm-hmm. that other kids will reach milestones, and as you notice those, you know that your kids might not be able to reach those. And it's not like you just get over this after a while. It's no. Like you live with it. And so when you're telling us to listen and to affirm, that's very helpful to people to try to understand.
Yeah, I have a few friends who, I call them trauma birthdays, because trauma lives in the body. It doesn't go anywhere. And no matter how old Liam gets, when his birthday rolls around, I have a really hard time. My body tells on me, and it has manifested in a few different ways, whether that's a dark mood and a real sense of sadness, or even kind of mania and a need to do a lot or prove that I'm not in the same place, ruminating thoughts. But it's one of those things that the more I have compassion for my body and my system, and the fact that that's based on truth, that we did experience that, and that it doesn't, it's never going to not be a part of me. You know, watching all of the lights go off and hearing all of the beeping sounds when your child is coding never leaves you.
No.
It never leaves you.
No.
So no matter how okay your kid is, you know, that kind of auto response is always there. And I have a few friends who know I'm getting very close to my kind of one of my big trauma birthdays right now. And I have a few really good, amazing friends who are like, how's it going? How are we feeling? You know, like, is there anything I can do? I've had friends in the past. One year was really, really hard. And I had a friend who just sent me a nightgown and like a candle, and it brought me to tears, you know, the kind of thing that brings you to your knees because it's so human and beautiful. And I think we spend so much energy as a society celebrating, and that's, I'm not saying that's wrong. I don't want anyone to mistake me. Let's celebrate the good things, please, especially now. But I think it's okay for us to walk the path of sorrow with the people we know who are on it.
Please,
I think
yes.
It's okay to check in and to validate and to see people who are in pain. They do want to be seen. And especially for you guys know, I mean, in terms of suicide prevention, see people. If we want people to live, it's okay that they're in pain. They're still valuable. They're still beautiful. They're still, I'm sometimes the funniest I ever am when I'm in complete crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that's my trauma response, but it's like, you know, I think we have so much more bandwidth than we give ourselves credit for as people. And I'm hopeful that if one person hears this and is able to make space for a friend that's in a bad way, that's everything. That's the ripple in the pond, you know?
Maybe send a nightgown and a candle. I love that. I read some advice from experts, quote unquote, that said when you have children that are a bit different, that you should rest, eat well, exercise, and take breaks. And I was just going to run that past you and say, is this realistic? Is this advice you would give people, Kim?
I would never say that to somebody because you're running around after the kids all the time. It is true. I mean, that's what everyone needs. I mean, duh. But coming by those things is so much harder when you're a parent or a single parent or a parent to kids who are young or a parent to kids who have any kind of differences.
Absolutely.
I have, I've gotten really good at scaling things back. Some of it's been intentional and some of it, like I said, has been, I think I'm a high maintenance friend. A lot of people have kind of bounced when they're like, oh, that's a lot. I don't have the capacity to go out at night very often. And a lot of women in my position and men feel the same. And even if you do, you know, we've been in periods where we need both of us here. It's not safe for one adult to be here with both kids because of one thing or another. If you go through a period of one of your kids being manic or one of your kids having elopement issues, like I said, or any variety of things,
and that means
no
you have
rest.
To be on extreme vigilance, which is very energy draining. Yeah.
Completely, and it sends you into a space where it's your energy drained, but your body can't stop. You know, so you can't rest even when you lay down. Your brain is still in hypervigilance and going, but did I do that? And I need to do this. And did I check the windows? And did I hear something just now?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. I had a complete, I guess what we would have called in the 60s or 70s, a nervous breakdown in 2019, and had to spend a few days I stayed home because I didn't want to check in somewhere because I was worried that we would lose services or my kids would be taken from me. And so we did kind of like just a hard 72-hour Brendan took over and pretend mommy's sick, and I slept a lot and, you know, got a little bit better at taking breaks, and then things got really hard with the kids and I got bad at taking my breaks, and then my whole body shut down. I started getting hives all over my face. My eyes started swelling up. I started having really intense, prolonged GI trouble, and I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder. And, you know, the funny thing about it is it's triggered by stress.
Exactly. Which is stressful to hear.
Of course. Not and fair. Also, like, but this is my life. I can't do anything about it.
Kim, if everything goes as well as it can under the knowledge that medical people have and psychologists have, and what are the best possibility outcomes for your child with Prader-Willi and the other? If let's say 5-10 years from now, if it all turns out as well as it can.
I mean, I think we are in a position with Liam where we're very hopeful that, you know, in 5 years he'll be graduating from high school. We've just gotten him, you know, we're doing more mainstream, we just put him into a private school. And so he is going to be in a position where we want to make sure that we support and scaffold him through his high school and probably early college years, because the so DMDD, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, is a new diagnosis from the DSM-5 that was created as a category because they saw a tremendous uptick in people diagnosing juvenile bipolar. And as you know, bipolar doesn't really present until later. And so this is kind of, it's presented to us in a couple of different ways as like a stopgap before a bipolar diagnosis and or a really, really intense manifestation of the dysregulation and stress and aggregation of ADHD and autism sensory overwhelm profile. We, you know, having experienced, you know, what we've experienced with him in the past, it's interesting because we go into a lot of assessments or meetings and we are told what we need to do if we want to get him into some good college or create some sort of, you know, outcome. And really my greatest hope is that my son lives and likes himself and learns how to create relationships with people who respect him and are kind. And so I think we are hoping that he'll stick around probably either at home or maybe living at home and doing like Pasadena City College. But we're also like very aware that there are a lot of different ways to contribute to society. And I am not the mom that needs her son to go to college. And I never really thought that I'd say that. I think that's really unpopular and I'm kind of afraid of what people will think, but for me, we've been through so much. I want my kids to live. I want them to be happy and create a life that they're proud of, and I really don't think that I know what that means. I'm not some oracle. With Nev, you know, it's a little different. Nev is most likely, you know, people typically do not live independently with Prader-Willi syndrome. Some people are able to that are very high functioning. We're really kind of early on the journey of what her needs are and learning more. You know, this year has been really a crash course in learning the difference between her type of Prader-Willi, UPD, and other types. And so I think we are going to be in hypervigilant town probably until she's about 22. She will need round-the-clock care. Right now, Nev is at a facility in Texas that has the only program I'm aware of in the world that provides intensive inpatient treatment for individuals with Prader-Willi syndrome. And the reason that that's critical is that it's the entire ward is a food safe environment. All the food is secure. None of the staff or anybody ever comes through with like a frappuccino or a drink. Everything is by menu, and the menu rotates every 5 weeks and it's posted, so the people with Prader-Willi know what's coming and can be excited about it and can maintain kind of their calm. And so this has been something that we had to seek out due to just a colossal failure, in my opinion, on the part of her doctors and the school district. You know, it's really hard to provide adequate care to a kid that needs extreme accommodations. And I don't think, you know, I don't think we should categorize any child's needs as extreme, but it's been made clear to me that getting Nev what she needs is going to be very challenging and a full-time job. I am very fortunate that we live in California. We receive something called respite care through the regional centers. In California, they split up social work into like regions, and every regional center has a designated number of caseworkers or social workers that are assigned to you. And so we were assigned a really spectacular caseworker. I've had caseworkers in 3 different states, and this woman is from the gods. She's amazing. She listens. She's had experience with somebody with Prader-Willi. And so we receive respite services, which means that we can contract with somebody that we choose to come into the home and be here to provide care for the children while we run errands or something like that at kind of an abysmal rate. But, you know, we've been able to find somebody that I have been hiring since we moved out here, one of my former students, actually, from one of the schools I taught at, who came out around the same time we did. And so she's exceedingly wonderful and knowledgeable and has learned about Prader-Willi with us and alongside us as Nev's needs have evolved. And so she comes occasionally and we have a little bit of help from her. And then I am typically just a captain mom. The kids, I have a few hours while the kids are at school to check in with the doctor's offices and manage medications and wash the soiled bedding. And then I pick the kids up, and we have a pretty, routines are really important to kids with rigid thinking and who are on the spectrum. And so I try to incorporate a lot of awareness of what's called restraint collapse, which is where the littles kind of like work all day really, really hard to hold themselves together and behave properly and listen and be still. And then they come home and it's like crazy. It's madness. It's just like, wah!
Yeah. They say.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, I am an in-home health and supportive services provider for Nev. And so the state of California actually pays me for the hours that I spend providing ambulatory care, meal and food prep, toileting assistance, all the things that I do, transportation to and from therapy, co-regulation through therapy. And I am able to make something of an income this way, which is life-saving for us.
Absolutely, and so necessary. We talked about the financial drawbacks, so kudos to California for their thoughtfulness and and care.
Indeed. And if you, you know, if you're listening and you are caring for an elderly family member or somebody with a developmental or physical or otherwise disability, look into whether or not your state has a program like this, because these programs exist because there are no longer places for people like Nev to go and live and be cared for. And there is a huge financial incentive for the state, every state, to keep these people in home as long as possible. We also know it provides much, much better outcomes for the patients to be in home, you know?
Mm-hmm. That is so powerful, Kim, for you to share with us your journey. We want to extend our deepest appreciation and respect for what you've learned and how you've utilized all your resources and how you're willing to help others with that.
Kim, before we have to tune out here in about 2 minutes, tell us some of the contact points with your website, your programs that are available that people want to go online and look you up.
Oh, well, all right. Not to pivot, but I will happily say that I have, as my aforementioned website, thekimgriffin.com, is a place where you can find materials about my artistic work and my teaching and reach out to me. I'm also on Instagram under the handle @thekimgriffin. You can reach out to me if you hear the program. I'm a real person. I may not get back to you right away because of all the things that you've just heard me say, but I'm happy to connect with other people who are walking this path, who are advocating for young people. I'm really passionate about speaking out for these public services, especially as we fight the one brutal bill. And I don't want anyone who is confused about it to be confused. Look me up. I'll help you find resources. We don't want that to pass. And then as far as my non-advocacy work, I am right now trying to, I'm pitching and trying to sell a short form comedy series called Dick Bunny. Dick Bunny is about a giant man rabbit named Richard Bunny who comes to life from a child's board book and shows up in the disheveled home of a sleep deprived mom named Max, who is played by me. Dick Bunny is a very surly individual and has basically horrible parenting advice and will not leave Max alone. And there are 6 episodes, and I will tell your audience that they can watch all 6 for free at dickbunny.com. And other than that, I'm teaching in the LA area, and that's about it right now. Just trying to keep my kids alive and teaching and trying to sell the show.
It's amazing what you're doing.
And the show is great. Everyone should check in on that show. Yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. It's a fun show. It's really about kind of the sense of isolation that comes with being a new parent, but also just how bizarre it can be to live in a world where you feel like everybody got the instructions for being a person but you. And as we've taken the show to all these festivals, we've been really surprised. We've been to a couple of festivals, some big ones and some new ones, and we've won some awards. It's been really cool. And we've met so many young people who are like, this show made me feel so seen. This show is so funny. And dads, we kind of really thought we were not going to get far with people that weren't moms. But I think it does have something for everybody. And it definitely has puppets. So even if you don't like babies or moms, you should show up for the puppets, because we worked with some incredible people from Jim Henson's masterclass, and it was just honestly the coolest experience. It's probably the only time I'll be able to do that, and I'm really glad we made it. We filmed it in my house, and it's just, it's a fun thing that exists.
It's very hilarious. Good
Kim,
for mental health.
Thank you so much. We thank Gallatin Valley listeners to tuning in to KGVM Health and Happiness. Please listen again. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you so much.